This is our number 10.
It's time for the fastest 15 minutes of the news. This is Dory's Fastest 15.
It's a world of news in a tidy little 15-minute package just for you. Welcome to our Fastest 15, coming up at 1:32 this afternoon, right after Ursula's newscast. James Holzhauer, who captured the nation's attention with that remarkable record run on Jeopardy. A few weeks ago, he was talking to MLB.com, and he said that he would like to work for a baseball front office. And one of the teams that he mentioned, he said his wife loves Seattle, and that he'd like to work for the Mariners, who, heaven knows, they could use some... Did you see the Mariners' numbers the last few days?
I know.
So they've lost six straight, 13 out of 15, and in the five games since the All-Star break, they've been outscored, I don't have it in front of me, but something like 38-9.
It felt like it was going to be different this year at the beginning of the season.
Oh, remember, you and Nicole tried peddling that nonsense.
I blame you. You had no faith.
Actually, I was the accurate one. It said this is a weird aberration at the beginning. James Holzhauer is going to join us right after the bottom of the hour. And I'm looking forward to talking to him because...
Nice get.
That's Nicole.
Good job.
Yeah, that's Thompson over there.
He does not do interviews.
He really wants a job here, though. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he knows if there's anybody who's a rainmaker here in Seattle, it's me.
He just opened all sorts of doors.
Oh, yeah. Boy, do I have connections here. But, I've told you many, many times that I was not... I mean, it wasn't just like a random goal, but from the ages of 14 until about 21... I was certain that I was going to be a professional gambler.
Mm-hmm. Which is funny because at 14, do you even know that that's a job?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I know
14,
you do.
Dory was like 29 at that point already.
True.
When I was 14, that's when I first learned how to play backgammon. And I remember the first night playing with my friend Pete. We were both just learning the game. And I was obsessed. And it was... The last thing I would think about as I was going to sleep. It was the first thing I would think about when I woke up in the morning.
Were you that kid that always like, hey, you want to bet on this? You want to bet on this? And you're always like, okay, I'll bet you $5, blah, blah, blah. Was that you?
I will tell you. This is absolute true story. At James Monroe Junior High School. So I'm trying to think how old I was. Because this was eighth grade. So I was 10 years old. And so all the other eighth graders are 13 and 14. I don't know. I've never told this story before. I had a table in the library where I would make book. And if people wanted to bet on that weekend's college and NFL games.
What?
Yeah. They
are
would come up.
Are you kidding me?
No.
That was allowed?
No one knew.
No.
You had a table.
Well, but I mean, it's in the back of the library.
Well, it's like...
Everyone else was just turned their heads,
selling
what?
Their erasers, and there Dory was doing a whole gambling book.
I remember there was a rack of books that hid it from the librarians, and I had the morning PI, which had the odds for the weekend's college and NFL game. So if anybody wanted to get some action.
How many middle schoolers were up for this?
I probably had about six or seven a week.
Terrible. You probably. Why is that
terrible?
Are those kids now?
Why is that
they
terrible?
They probably have gambling problems. They're
probably all degenerates now. Yes. So, or they're talk show hosts somewhere. I don't know. But that was the thing. I would get just maniacally obsessed. And so once I started getting into backgammon, like I said, it was within 3 years, I was down in Tahoe playing in the U.S. Open I can't even describe the level of obsession that I would have for things like that. So maybe James and I can bond over that. So I'll talk with him about all of that. So James Holzhauer is coming up in about 20 minutes. As you just heard in Ursula's newscast, now we have been covering Dow Constantine for the last couple of months rather extensively and exclusively here on the Dory Monson Show, along with reporter Carolyn Osorio. We had multiple sources who told us about Dow Constantine abusing his executive protection detail. He would use them as his private Uber. He would go out drinking pretty much every night, drinking and womanizing, according to my sources. And even though he's in a long term, he's been living with a woman for, I don't know, many, many, many years. But that's what our sources have been telling us. And our sources, some of whom are within the sheriff's department. And yesterday we told you the story about retaliation, where Dow Constantine has suspected one of his executive protection deputies of being the source of our stories. And so, and by the way, this guy was not the source, but Dow Constantine suspected that he was. And so it is alleged that Dow Constantine, every time this guy is assigned to protect Dow Constantine, and think about that. These guys, they literally are supposed to lay down their life for the person they're protecting. And every time this guy is assigned to protect Dow Constantine, he gets removed from the executive protection detail, which is, you know, a nice overtime gig for some of these people, even though the guy's not our source. Even though Mitzi Jo Hanknik said in a memo there would be no retaliation for anybody who spoke to Cairo Radio. But this is the kind of sleazebag that Dow Constantine is. It reveals the character of the liar that is Mitzi Jo Hanknik and the fact that she will not honor her commitment to come on our show. We soft-pedaled that for about 3 months now, and I'm soft-pedaling it no more. She is a liar. And when you have a liar at the top of your police department, that is a pretty critical issue for the public. Now, today's story from the Seattle Times, a complaint from the former head of the King County Parks Department says that Dow Constantine pressured Parks to give a concessions deal to David Meinert. Now, David Meinert is very well-known local restaurant and nightclub owner. As Ursula just mentioned, 11 women have filed allegations of anything from sexual assault to sexual misconduct against David Meinert. If you have ever read the details, and I'll give credit. KUOW did a great story. They talked to several of the women. And what this David Meinert is alleged to have done to these women is pretty horrific. The fact that Dow Constantine now allegedly funneled multi-million dollar contracts to David Meinert, who was one of his campaign boosters and donors, that's more than a little troubling, but it is consistent with everything that we have come to learn about Dow Constantine, who, according to our sources, is a pretty heavy drinking womanizer who abuses his executive protection detail. Dow, you are welcome to come on my show anytime and refute the things that we say from our sources, through our sources, because of our sources. I have rock-solid sources that make me comfortable in saying things that are pretty explosive about you on the air. And then you have this Seattle Times story that alleges that Dow Constantine was funneling $2.5 million in food and beverage contracts for the Marymore Park concert series and Cirque du Soleil performances to David Meinert, who had donated a lot of money to Dow Constantine's campaign over the years. He's hosted fundraisers for Constantine, and I am telling you, the sleaze at the top of King County right now is as bad as I have ever seen. And we'll keep following this because we are getting daily tips I got another tip about Dow Constantine yesterday. I got a Blockbuster tip about Mitzi Johanknik yesterday. The more we talk about it, the more people who work for the county are coming forward with very credible information about just how bad this is. And I will tell you, I know a lot of men and women who work for the King County Sheriff's Department. And they're friends of mine. They're wonderful people. And the morale under Johanknik is sinking like a rock. King County's a mess with Dow Constantine. And the voters get what they deserve in these cases. So we will keep you posted on all of these developing details. Next up in the Fastest 15. You also mentioned the Showbox Theater in your newscast.
Yes.
Okay, so I want to make sure I understand this. So they've granted historic landmark status.
For the building.
For the building.
Yes.
But they don't say that it has to continue as a theater.
No.
I wonder if people understand how troubling this is. This is the Seattle City Council stealing $40 to $60 million from a private person. Nothing is more important in a free land than private property rights. The owner of the Showbox was going to sell it to this Canadian developer. They were going to build a 44-story high-rise, and they are just simply stealing it by telling him he can no longer sell it for his desired purpose. And
this was the Landmarks Preservation Board that did the vote yesterday.
Yes.
Just to be clear.
But okay. It was at the behest of the council,
yes.
Which... Now, I did the math on this, too, of what this is going to cost the taxpayers of this region, because I talked to some downtown commercial real estate people, and we estimated when I first did this story that the Showbox probably sold for $30 to $60 million. That was rock solid. It was sounds like it was about $40 million now. But that would generate condos. That, first of all, the developer in Vancouver was hoping to profit $250 million. So this landmark board is stealing $250 million from a private company. So they and you know, look, I've been to the show. Have you been to the Showbox? Been to a concert there?
No.
Okay. Have you ever been there?
Yes, I have.
Sean, you been to the Showbox?
Yeah, I've been there several times.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The music, I don't even remember who I saw there. It was way, way back. But the building, it's a mess. It's a rat hole. The memories associated with the building or something, but... They're stealing $40 million from the owner. They're stealing $250 million from the Vancouver company that was going to build and develop it. And then I did some more math. So if you have $600 million worth of condos in that building, the property taxes would be at least $6 million per year. They go up every year. Over the next 30 years, King County would collect $250 million in property taxes. Not only that, every time one of those condos sells, 1.78%, the real estate excise tax, that's another $50 million in lost real estate excise tax dollars. So because people feel sentimental about the music that was in a rundown building, they feel justified to steal $40 million from the building's owner. They feel justified to steal $250 million from the company that was going to develop it. They feel justified to steal $300 million tax dollars from Seattle and King County. And for what? This is... And, you know, we saw this years ago with the Critical Areas Ordinance, where King County just stole the personal property of rural landowners in King County and declared it wetlands, untouchable. That was just a stealing. If you do not think this could happen to you, you're wrong. And if people stand idly by while the city council and the Landmark Preservation Board steals over $500 million from people.
Can you think of any buildings in the city of Seattle that would be worth preserving in that way?
Smith Tower.
Smith Tower. If they said, well, Smith Tower, you know, it at one point was one of the tallest, but it certainly isn't. They could build a much bigger tower.
Smith Tower at one point was the tallest building west of the Mississippi.
Right.
The Space Needle. The Showbox ain't. I mean, it's just a box. I mean, it's in the name.
Yeah. And is it mostly, because I'm trying to look at, you know, is there anything specific about the building itself that is special? And it does sound like it's mostly the acts that have performed there, right? I mean, is that
exactly
what it is?
Right. Yeah. People have fond memories. You know what? The Seattle Center Arena, it had the one on 5th and Mercer. It had unbelievable concert lineups for its 45 years or whatever it was as a venue. But that's gone now.
Your friend, you should have a conversation with Duff McKagan. He is one of those that
we did when it first started.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I must not have been here.
No, and what I said to him is, you know, you and all your buddies in the music industry, if you want to come up with the market value, $40 million that the owner was going to sell it to the Vancouver Group, mm-hmm. If you guys want to come up with $40 million and operate it at a multi-million dollar loss every year, because if you know you're carrying a contract on $40 million, no way do you make the nut operating that as a concert venue.
Right.
But at least the free market is doing something about it. But when government just runs roughshod over people like this, it's really disturbing. It's disgusting. Okay, and all of that is your Fastest 15.
This has been the Fastest 15 Minutes of the News. Fast Stories, Fastest 15.
You give us 15 minutes, we'll give you the world.
Or two stories.
I was passionate about that. I was very, very passionate about those stories. Okay, coming up, Ursula's going to check the news, and then the guy who captured the nation's attention with his record run on Jeopardy. Jeopardy James. James Holzhauer joins us next on the Dory Monson Show. Well, as you know, listening to the show, several weeks ago, I and the rest of America was absolutely transfixed by just a terrific run on the show Jeopardy by a guy named James Holzhauer, who won well over $2 million. But it was the way he won that just absolutely fascinated me. And then I heard he was a professional sports gambler, which was at one point early in my life my aspiration. And I said, I knew I had to talk to this guy. So from Las Vegas, James Holzhauer joins us here on the Dory Monson Show. Hey, James, it's great to talk with you.
Hi, Dory.
Have things settled down a bit for you in the week since the on-air run ended?
I guess a bit is the right term. There's still, you know, a shocking to me amount of public interest in me, but it's slowing down just a tad.
Yeah. I mean, that had to be just absolutely crazy, though, to go from an unknown to one episode got 14 million viewers. And you were the sensation in a real fractured television world. Everybody came together to watch you run.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. You know, the successful sports bettors tend to try to keep an intentionally low profile, and that kind of blew up overnight for me. So.
I guess the reason, and I know my producer Nicole told you this, when I was 14, 15, 16, I was pretty good with math, and I was absolutely determined. And I didn't know what my game was going to be, James, but I was going to be a professional gambler. I played in the U.S. Open backgammon tournament when I was 17. I was able to do speed figures before they showed up in the racing form and did pretty well at the track. But everything always caught up to me. How do you stay ahead of the game as a professional gambler?
It's definitely a challenge. You know, if I try to do the same stuff I was doing 12 years ago, I would just get destroyed today. You know, you kind of have to keep evolving along with the times. And, you know, sometimes you'll find an angle and it works really well for a month or so, and then the bookie catches on to what you're doing and just everything adjusts. You know, sometimes when one bookmaker changes things up, everyone else follows along, even if they don't understand why. to innovation, I guess I would say.
And so you're constantly evolving and innovating. And I guess what fascinates me about that, James, is so's everybody else who's trying to beat the book. And there are a lot of brilliant people and a lot of Ivy Leaguers with very high-powered computers. And everybody's trying to get that edge. So how in the world can you continually get enough of an edge to make a living at that?
Well, a lot of it comes down to just being willing to outwork the opposition. But, you know, you also have to have these valuable insights of kind of, and I would say a third thing, I guess, is just always look at everything. You know, I used to bet only baseball because I didn't think I knew anything about the other sports. But, you know, if you do a deep enough dive, you can find something and, you know, work on exploiting it as long as they'll let you. I kind of stepped away from baseball betting now because they're really getting good at setting their odds, but, you know, finding more stuff in hockey and football to work on.
Are you a grinder or a plunger? And do you just try to find a steady 4% edge, or do you find an edge and jump in with both feet?
Oh, God, if I could get a 4% edge on everything, I would love that. No, I mean, there's sometimes going to be, like, some props and futures that offer, you know, a big double-digit return on investment, but for the most part, you know, if you're betting games, you're looking to just get a couple percent here or there. And if you can do that over 50 games a week, you're going to do great.
You have a family, right?
Yes, I have a wife and a young daughter.
Now, is that a challenge? Because that was something I had to come to grips with. My wife and I have three daughters. They're all in their 20s now. But back when I was, before I was married and I was thinking about that life, James, I was also thinking, is that a family life? How in the world do you balance that?
Well, it's a challenge. You know, one of the things is it's great that I can work from home, but it also means that, you know, my kid sees me around all day and figures, hey, daddy's home, I can play with him. You know, it doesn't always work out that way, especially on a football weekend.
Yeah.
I would say that it's kind of a double-edged sword, like being around but not being around all the time. It's nice that I get to set my own hours, though. I think that's an important aspect of whatever's next for me, is I need to have a fairly flexible schedule, prioritize the family time.
What makes you so different? Because your brain clearly works in a remarkable way. And is that something you realized at a young age? Because, you know, I've been watching Jeopardy. I was watching Jeopardy as a little kid when Art Fleming was the host. I mean, back in the late 60s. And I've always thought, I'm okay. I was in awe of you and the stuff that you were able to pack away. When did you realize you had a brain that was capable of some pretty extraordinary stuff?
You know, I was kind of labeled a prodigy when I was a young kid. I don't know that I necessarily agree with that label. But, you know, one thing I think that really helped me is I didn't put any limits on myself based on what past contestants on Jeopardy have been able to achieve. You know, I thought, hey, this, you know, the ceiling is really far and above what everyone else has done before me. If people just played the game differently, they could achieve this. And, you know, it was nice that I was the one who was able to get there, but really I would have been excited to see anyone trying this kind of audacious play up there.
Yeah, but it takes some guts. I mean, because thinking outside of the box is still a rarity, even though I think everybody understands that that's the way you break out, but it's still something that there's something in most of us that constrains us from being innovators, it seems.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you know, sometimes people need to see someone else doing it before they realize it's possible. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I never would have imagined someone slugging 800 like Barry Bonds did every year, or hitting 5 threes a game the way Steph Curry does now, you know, but someone has to try it and show that it works.
Yeah, what the heck happened to us, James? You said you were a prodigy. I was 15 when I graduated high school and started college, and look at us now. You're a sports gambler, and I'm a radio talk show host. We could have actually changed the world, James, if we had channeled it elsewhere.
Oh, okay. Thanks for that downer note.
Well, no, here's what I heard you want to do next, because you know, the first reason we wanted to reach out with you was what you said here on MLB Network.
I don't know. You know, I like living in Las Vegas. I'm not especially keen to move, but, you know, my wife loves Seattle. She maybe can put a word out to the Mariners for her.
Oh, yes. Jerry DePoto, yeah.
We know Jerry pretty well. We can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell you what, James, Mariners need some help right about now.
Yeah.
But is that your real dream and goal? You'd like to be the last or the latest generation Moneyball guy?
Well, as a teenager, that was definitely the dream. You know, the dream of family man James might not be exactly the same, but I will say I had a nice chat with some people from the Mariners front office. They really seem like, you know, results on the field be damned. They're running a good operation there and have a good long-term goal in mind. I should have put out a reach to, I think, the Seahawks or the new hockey team, and I'm temporarily calling the Seattle Freeze, because I think that there's more room for improvements in those sports. Honestly, you know, the baseball front office, they're really doing a great job now. They're kind of working harder and harder to get smaller and smaller edges over the competition, whereas I think some other sports are lagging behind and they could really use the help more.
Well, that fascinates me that you say that, because I do the Seahawks pre- and post-game radio, and I talk to Pete Carroll on my show every Friday. And I've talked with him about that a lot, about analytics in football. And I know that every team in the NFL feels like they are on the cutting edge, and they certainly all have analytics departments. But do you think that's a sport that could do a lot more than what it's currently doing?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, if you set like a computer to play the optimal game of, say, football or hockey, it would look pretty different, I think, than what they're doing right now. Whereas in baseball, I think it would look strategically fairly similar to everything that's going on. You know, 10 years ago, I would have said, hey, teams need to be shifting more. They need to adjust their batting orders more to give their players more at-bats. But, you know, teams are really doing all this stuff now. They're not ignoring any of the obvious low-hanging fruit. You got to just climb a ladder now to pick the high fruit that's still there.
Without giving away what's swirling around in your brain, can you give me one example of where you think football could change dramatically by introducing that concept?
I would say that the simplest thing is that teams should just pass more than they are. You know, passing plays on average are still much more effective. They add more to the team's chances of winning than running plays do, and yet teams are still running the ball like way more than they ought to be.
Yeah, I don't know if the Seahawks are your team, because Pete Carroll's absolutely committed to the run, man.
Well, you know, he's shown that that's going to be a winning approach, too, so I would hate to doubt Pete.
Yeah, that's true. Well, James, it's really fun talking with you, as you can tell. I love all of this stuff, but more than anything, I loved watching your run. I had stopped watching Jeopardy live every night. I always had it on my DVR, but man, that became appointment television. Then, you know, people were talking about how you had ruined the game, and I thought, are you crazy? This is the most fun I've ever seen on this show.
Yeah, well, you know, the episodes all taped before they haven't really aired any episodes featuring contestants who have been able to see me on television. So some people out there are wondering if the game is going to change in the upcoming season with people having seen me and before they go to tape, and maybe they'll adapt to new strategies, but I don't know. I'm excited to see it.
Yeah, and also I know, you know, Alex Trebek was so publicly battling his illness, and I know that you've given a chunk of your winnings to pancreatic cancer research, and I'm sure that that's a relationship that you will treasure, because, I mean, he's just one of the most beloved guys in the country.
Yeah, you know, we're not supposed to fraternize with the employees of the show because they had these scandals 60 years ago, and, you know, everything has to appear above board now. But, you know, just getting to spend a little time with Alex is really a treasure. I really hope he keeps the fight going for years and years so other contestants can get that pleasure.
Yep, there you go. All right. James, really fun talking with you. If something pops with the Mariners or Seahawks or the new hockey team here, I'd love to reconnect with you sometime.
All right. Pleasure. Thank
you. Okay. All right. Take care. James Holzhauer, Jeopardy James, who just captured the nation a couple of months ago with that tremendous run. Love to hear your thoughts. The Online Trading Academy text line is 98973. Lots more straight ahead here on the Dory Monson Show. Oh, it is just hilarious. I guess. It's also so pathetic. And CNN, MSNBC, they're just on the Trump, the crowd chanting, send her back to Ilhan Omar. I can't wait till all this stuff comes out on Ilhan Omar. But they're around the clock on this, and probably will be for another day. and then they'll move on to something else that'll have no legs, just like everything they've done. I mean, why don't they bring back the, who's the porn star? I can't even remember her name.
Stormy Daniels.
Stormy Daniels. They did Stormy Daniels every day for months. Nothing. Collusion, nothing. Treason, nothing. Racist, nothing. When everything's an 11, nothing's an 11. But Trump has now spoken out. Just a little bit ago at the Oval Office, he said that he wasn't happy with the crowd at his rally in North Carolina chanting, send her back.
Well, number one, I think I did. I started speaking very quickly. It really was a loud, I disagree with it, by the way, but it was quite a chant. And I felt a little bit badly about it. But I will say this, I did, and I started speaking very quickly. But it started up rather fast, as you probably noticed.
So you'll tell your supporters never to
Well, say I would say that. I was not happy with it. I disagree with it. But again, I didn't say that. They did. But I disagree.
That's very rare for Trump. They must have done some flash polling and figured out that, yeah, this one could hurt. So he claims that he disagreed with it. I don't think he disagreed with it, to be honest with you. He started it with the tweet. So if they don't like it here, they should go back and fix the countries they came from. Oh, that reminds me. I have some Kashama Sawant news that I'm going to get to in the big lead at 2. Also, more details on how the Dems want to squeeze every penny possible out of you, and how Sound Transit's screwing over business owners. All straight ahead.